Всім добрий вечір.
On behalf of the brave.
Hello and welcome to Tochny Weekly, the show that gets behind the headlines to discuss the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine. Please follow our main account on Twitter for more information about all the projects we do. All Tochny content is available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Please subscribe to the platform of your choice to stay up to date on our content and give us a rating if you're so inclined. We have an excellent show for you this week. First, Daniele will discuss the situation regarding mines in the Black Sea. Next, Ben will discuss the statement made by Reznikov that 3% of the war effort so far has been funded by volunteer contributions. And finally, John will discuss the recent news regarding attack-ums to Ukraine and some other pieces of news that we've become aware of. So without any further delay, I will turn it over to our first presenter, Daniele. Daniele, go ahead.
Hi, and good evening to everyone, at least for who is in Europe. And yeah, today, essentially, you can consider today talk about Black Sea and mines, an introduction, if you wish, to what is going to happen tomorrow, which probably will go much more in details. And I really recommend everyone who is interested in this topic to try to listen to tomorrow interview, because it's very important to understand the geography and the physics behind the currents, the waves, and the climate of Black Sea in order to understand the current situation and the possible development. Because as on land, on sea, these things actively affecting the war and the dire warfare behind is a very, very intricate part to the warfare. So I really encourage everyone to attend this. Now, today we are going to deep dive onto essentially three topics. And the first one is about the Ukrainian Navy before the war, of course. And then we are going to discuss a little bit, just touch the currents that exist in the Black Sea. And we will look specifically to the currents that were occurring thanks to satellite image and the mathematical model that are done by different researchers around Europe in order to understand the Black Sea for different reasons, not only due to the war, but which can give us some important understanding on how Black Sea works and how certain things can be demonstrated to be false. And last but not least, we will try to discuss also the timeline events that led to the alarm of the around 420 drifting mines in the Black Sea, and we will go through some conclusion trying to in order to understand also how mines roughly works, not going too much in detail, but trying to take the key point that enable us to understand how mine field in water works and how these can help us to identify misleading information from the Russians. Now, starting from the very beginning, I had the opportunity to go through a series of documents and which are partially published, partially not. These are very important because they allow us to understand the capabilities of the Ukrainian Navy just prior to the war. Of course, the capabilities of the Ukrainian Navy were very, very bad. We are going very soon to understand why I say this, but it's important to do a step even back, not at the takeover of Crimea, but to the end of the Soviet Union. Because if we want to understand really this conflict and why is Crimea so important for Ukraine, but also for Russia, it's important to remind what happened in the period after the independence. So in that period, the Soviet Union Navy in the Black Sea was around 300 vessels and was a substantially larger navy for the time, and at that point wasn't possible for both countries, Russia and Ukraine, having like 50-50%, because Ukraine was not capable of maintaining such large fleet. So at that point, the politician at the time decided to split the entire fleet roughly in 18% of all the assets, including ships and ports, to Ukraine. So 18% to Ukraine and the rest, and the remaining part to the Russian Federation. Now, this process that looks very smooth and like done with a scalpel, in reality was very difficult, because the Soviet Navy, even at the time, wasn't at the best condition, and some vessel and some infrastructure were in a better shape than others. And for unknown reason to me at the moment, at the time, Russians were left able to decide what to keep and what to give back. And when I say this, I talk about three carrier or helicopter transport ships, a series of cruiser and corvettes and frigates, and around 30 submarines, just to give you an idea of the amount of material, plus a very large amount of assault and amphibious landing ships, and roughly also 200 between helicopters and airplane. So this was essentially the backbone of Black Sea Fleet, and this was separated in this way. Now, these things dragged for some years until 1997, when once the two countries agree on most of the point, and the division was made. And surprise, surprise, Russians were very able to leave to Ukraine whatever was in bad condition, unoperable to the point that was just scrap metal, or was very, very complex for a so young navy to maintain, especially thinking that at the time when this split occurred, Ukraine was able to commit only 2% of its entire defense budget to the Navy. And this was not changed until 2014. So you can imagine why Ukrainian Navy always struggled until 2014 as well. I stress this point because when I say the Navy was split, also the infrastructure, so the ports, the repair yard, were somehow split. And of course, you cannot take land and occupy unless you're Russia nowadays, but you can completely disassemble stuff and bring back to Russia, which has been done, and leaving behind old or damaged equipment, which essentially was more a problem rather than a resource. So this just to give you an idea on how they arrived to 2014. And 2014 essentially represents a subsequent drama for the Ukrainian Navy, because they lost Sevastopol, a very large amount of ships and other logistics, plus the men. Because it's very important to underline that also not in 2014, but before, when the Soviet Union collapsed, some of the officers and a very large part of the Navy officer and went to Russia. So there was a very big gap. So this led us to modern days and what was left of the fleet. So in terms of real capability, if you go on Wikipedia, it's an okay navy. I mean, it's not super efficient, has a lot of issues, but has some capabilities. But the difference between what is on Wikipedia or mostly public knowledge is different from what was really operative. And when I say really operative, I discuss with some people who are more within this topic, means that you have ships that can leave your national water, stay away in international water on mission for maybe 30 days. And this was a very challenging task for Ukrainian Navy. And the only one ship that can operate in a hostile environment, for example, doing anti-piracy activity, was the Hetman, which was the only frigate left from this period, and even after the 2014 Crimea takeover. So this was just one ship, which has good capabilities, but it's just one, which have to operate in a very hostile environment where the Russian Navy has much higher capabilities. Now, the other small ship that was able to operate to some extent, a very small vessel known, the class should be the Matka, is a project 206 MR. So essentially, at the time of the Soviet Union, was a fast attack boat, which was essentially used as an anti-ship missile launcher. So it has two Termit P-15 missiles. But after the collapse of the Soviet Union, And after the break with the Soviet Union, essentially they had to rip off these missiles because they don't have access to this. So essentially, this boat was only able to shoot with an autocannon and a 76 millimeter cannon. So you can imagine it can do something, but it's very, very limited. And many analysts that I spoke with, they say, well, this was the Ukrainian Navy at the time. Of course, there were other assets, like a lot of patrol boat, gunboat, of like the Project 376, so small, very small, or the Project 1400N, GRIF for NATO. So these were very small, and these are very small boats. Why I'm introducing you and doing this list of the boat? Because if you go in one of the slides that we published today, probably the very first with all these ships that I was currently talking to you about, you will see that we have the Hetman, a Project 130, which is a mine layer. This was one of the few that was even returned from Crimea. And then the A500, which was a common ship, and some others. And you can see a red symbol that says lost vessel. So essentially, immediately after the start of the invasion, most of the vessel, the good vessel, were sunk or sunk by the command, the ship commander that understood the severity of the problem and preferred to sink the ship rather than get captured from the Russians. So now we don't know exactly the mine layer when it was sunk, but reports say that this was sunk immediately after the invasion and possibly at a very, very early stage, so between the end of February and the start of March. And this time frame is very, very important for what is going next. So we arrive now to understanding that the capabilities of the Ukrainian Navy to deploy mines were heavily undermined, essentially immediately after the invasion started. We know that they were able to lay some mine in order to try to defend all the area and all the bay in front of Odessa and all the areas on the east of Odessa, especially in on the coastline, in order to avoid assault ship and amphibious assault to these beaches. Now, at this point, is the geography of the Black Sea and the current system of the Black Sea came very, very, very important. And now, if you go through the slide that has been published today, you will find one which shows you a map of the Black Sea in blue, white, and blue color. Now, these maps are publicly accessible, so you can go on this website. Later on, I will tweet where I took these, of course, but these are from Copernicus Archive, which Copernicus Marine Archive, which is a project of European Union, which studies seas, European seas and worldwide seas, and also Black Sea, which is very, very important for this reason. Economically speaking, is important to understand current, understanding the pH of the water, temperature, to understand also migration of different species, and understanding the pollution and many other factors. So it's a very well-studied sea. And what we can see is trying to understand and trying to look how current works in the Black Sea. Now, of course, this has a degree of flexibility because nothing is static and there are changes during the years, of course. But in the season between the 15 and the 17, so between the middle of February and the middle of March, the currents assume a very constant behavior. If you can roll back in the years, and you will see that the sea has its own climate and its own physics, and this is not repeatable, but has a trend, okay, during the year. Now, in this period of time, you can see from this image, these are the eastward current. So this means that these currents are positive and red when they push through Russia or to the east, from the west to the east, and blue, negative, when they push in the reverse direction, okay? And you can see from the image that there is a kind of double S shape that essentially have current that goes from Russia to Romania, and in the middle you have Crimea. And Crimea as you can see from the image, act as like a barrier to this current. In fact, the area above Sebastopol and below Odessa is nearly white, and there are some coloring, but essentially this means that there is not exactly a precise current in the east from the on the eastern or the western side. And this because in this area we have a kind of neutral behavior, which doesn't mean that there is no current. It means that current tends to recirculate here. And this will be very, very important for another point that we are going to make in a few minutes. Now, so you go from Russia, you go from east to west, and then normally the currents essentially on Romania and tends to go down to the Bosphorus and then accelerate again going east and passing over the coast of Turkey, for example, where you can see a very high peak of red, because in this point they have like a kind of acceleration. And of course, this is influenced by many, many things. Now, we are talking about nearly surface current for this case. And this is important because the topic that we are discussing is about mines and potentially drifting mines. So mines that are on the surface or nearly the surface of the sea. And as any object that is left, even a boat without engine in the sea, will follow these currents. Understanding these currents is very difficult because there are different impacts, but we can have, like, from this image, an idea of what a mine left somewhere would go preferably. And you can imagine if it's left from Odessa, it's very difficult and at least not impossible, but very, very challenging for this mine to go downward, enter into the current, and then go anywhere. And this is very important because this can happen, but cannot happen at the same level of frequency that we observe until now. And there are also other issues here. The first one is that yesterday we posted a very nice animation about an animation that show you actually the current. And a very nice thing that you can see from this animation is how in the period where this accident started, the current were essentially like the one that we show in this colored slide, but also circulating against the Odessa and all the beaches around Odessa. And in fact, these things happen quite often and is quite normal for the Black Sea. And this also explains why some mines that get loose ended up on Ukrainian coastline, causing also very severe damage and also sometimes issues, and some people died for this. Now, in the third and last slide that I prepared, you have essentially, okay, one of the type of mine that has been shown and some of the key event here. Now, we know that on the 3rd of March, an Estonian-owned cargo ship known Elf sank off the Odessa coastline, a bit far away from areas that we know were mined with more mined or anchored mines. So mine that normally have some kind of anchor which embed them and force them to stay in place to defend an area. Now, these mines were deployed by Ukrainian Navy for the simple reason that they wanted to essentially do a kind of area denial. So they wanted to deny to adversary forces without the knowledge of where the mine were, the coastline. So they want to be sure that no one can approach. And there is a very nice image of a cover shore that show essentially the fleet, the Russian fleet, coasting the coastline very well away from this area because they knew they were mined. Now, it's possible, of course, that few of these mines, due to rough sea, due to aging, because it looks like that these were also quite old mines, could get loose and go away. But as I show you in the animation that now has been posted again, and the previous the slide with the currents, it's very, very unlikely that a very large amount, and we counted, Ben did a very amazing job in trying to get all the accident that currently occurred. And for accident, we say also accident is when a mine was discovered and someone like the Romanian Navy or the Turkish Navy disabled them, were roughly 70. Now, Ben could just correct me if I got this number wrong. But this number is quite high respect to the distance, the time at which accident occurred. And also, it's very difficult for this mine to drift in this way when you have such particular current. Now, in all these timeline events, we have on the 3rd of March this type of accident, so the health sank, unfortunately. There are a lot of discussion on how this happened, if this was caused by a mine that was not drifting, but was essentially just below the water level, was dark, and somehow this impact against the ship, which was too close to this mine area, still, or was a drifting mine. We still don't know this, but what we know is that on the 22nd of March, Russia published an alert where, and was this 22nd of March, and they say that about 420 mines were of two precise types, Yam and Yarm, were left. So the statement say breaking off. So the Ukrainian naval forces is essentially breaking off, laying such mine by Ukrainian naval force is a violation of Hague Convention of 1987. Now, essentially, they were saying in this alarm that Ukrainian Navy was on purpose deploying drifting mine or having mine that were anchored get loose in order to impede navigation. Now, apart the fact that many people, many analysts and people that saw these were in alarm, but first of all, 420 mine get loose in such short period of time for a navy that essentially has lost two of the mine sweeper at the very, very beginning, and probably is about of losing the only mine layer, which, by the way, was also upgraded more for mine sweeping capability rather than improving its mine laying capability, is very, very unlikely to happen. What is also another take, apart the fact that they know exactly the number and the type of mine, is the fact that a drifting mine, so a mine that is floating anchored, is used to deter an enemy force to approach your coastline or an area that you want to deny the access to. Instead, a drifting mine is perfectly legal. You can do that, but the mine has to blow itself up in 1 hour after this happened. So you want to do this when you want to hit a fleet that is coming to you, or you want to deter a certain type of movement. And this is also done on land when, for example, you shoot 155 millimeter round with mines and you shoot behind forces moving in an area in order to prevent or create more damage when they retreat or to block any enemies going to reinforce those positions. And this mine normally tends to have a timer and disable themselves. Also because then probably you want to cross this water, this land. So essentially the idea on behind the drifting mine is the same. Now, why Ukrainian has to do this is debatable, because of course currents would probably bring this mine back to the shoreline. Done in this way would hamper their capability of having other countries coming to take the grain, because at the very beginning this was a problem mostly for Ukrainians. So all these things put together essentially tends to say that this is very unlikely a job done on purpose by a ship just dropping mines into the sea, because this would be not effective in impeding the movement of the Russian Navy, which was already working from behind, because they were well aware of the anti-naval capabilities of Ukraine. And the other important aspect is that they don't have enough vessel to displace that amount of mines, because one of these mines is around 176 kilograms, roughly. So in order to lay all these mines and let them loose, it takes you a lot of time. And it has completely no sense and is so dangerous to go in a minefield that you created and try to essentially free this mine, because any movement can be fatal. And you have just one vessel that can do this. So it's very, very unlikely that all these things happen just to cause more harm than benefit. And today I'm not going to speculate on where this mine can come from, but I can say without any doubt that the announcement done on the 22nd of March was completely false and misleading, probably used to masquerade a smoking gun of something that they were up to do. But it's probably true that some mine get loose. And some mine returned in Ukrainian beach line, creating problems, and some may have drifted as well. But in that short amount of time between the start of the war and the 22nd of March, this do not have the possibility of physically occurring, because there was not enough vessel, there was not enough capabilities, and there was so much risk for the Ukrainian Navy to move in those water to do this type of operation. Also, because if you want to lay the mine, you need to know very well the currents, and you want to go probably far away from your coastline and from your defenses in order to do such operation. And this essentially conclude the analysis that I wanted to bring to you. And if there is any question, I'm very happy to reply. I may have forgot something, so if you have any question, I'm happy to reply. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I have a question, Daniele. So do you have any information about what sort of anchoring the mines in question are using?
Okay, so I didn't went in depth of the type of anchor. Now, the true type of mine that we know both Russia and Ukraine operate are these Yarmy pipe. These are normally mines that operate with a physical connection to a base, which can or keep the mine in a certain balance. But most of these mines essentially do not work on very deep water. They work essentially not too far away from coastline. So they are using the ground in order to have like an attachment point. Now, the point that some people always say, oh, maybe the current tends to move the anchor. The anchor is not very well latched to the soil, so it can just slowly drift. That's possible, but the problem is that most of these miners were on the surface. So this means that the anchor completely failed or something catastrophic happened to the anchor. And even if the first case occurred, the miner wouldn't go that far away anyway. So it's probably important to investigate more about this. I was trying to find more technical information about these old mines, because we all agree these are not new mines. These are Soviet-era mines, for sure. But the problem is that all these war, both the countries are using the same equipment from Soviet-era as well. Now we start to see new equipment, but for mines, they are mostly doing the same. Of course, Russia has also new mines that can be laid from their submarine as well. So, like bottom mines or torpedo mines, but these are different type of mines. These are very old, essentially, contact or magnetic mines. I think these are essentially very, very old mines that works with an electrolyte that once the vessel enter into contact with the mine, it just ignite and start the explosion. So they are very old concept.
Detailed, clear answer. That was absolutely fantastic. Beautiful, beautiful treat. Thank you. The way you showed that it was absolutely impossible for the mines that were found in the Bosphorus as well as in the Danube to be laid by Ukraine at the moment when it is the most likely for them to have been laid was brilliant. And mathematically, it showed that those mines should not have been where they were found, and that it's very likely that they were actually planted there consciously by Ukraine's enemy, and namely Russia. And what was very clear as well was the enormous campaign that happened on Twitter, as well as on other social media. All those conclusions have been reached thanks to Daniela's research. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben. And as you mentioned, I think both you and Daniela, you'll be attending tomorrow the interview. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to be covering more prospective aspects of the question. We're going to look at whether it's possible for Russia to lay mines just right in front of a ship that is traveling from Odessa to Istanbul through NATO waters, because that's a very legitimate fear, which is the fact that if you've got a minesweeper, you can have a submarine just sneaking right behind it and dropping a couple of mines right behind the minesweeper, and then you're like, oh, well, you know, who knows what whose minds those were. And we're going to see to what extent this fear is grounded and to what extent the geography of the Black Sea is making that very option potentially not as possible and not as worrisome as some might think.
I think actually, Ben, your topic is next, the 3% topic. So if you want to take it away, go ahead.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, 3%. So you all know that Alexei Reznikov has left the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense last week, and in his party interview, it was actually published after his dismissal, he mentioned two very interesting numbers. The first one, which we knew already, is the fact that the Ukrainian MOD is spending, on average, $100 million every day. We know that because we know that their annual budget is something to the tune of $40 billion. So that makes sense for them to, on average, spend $100 million. What we didn't know is the second part he said. And what he said was that 3% of those $100 million were actually spent not by the MOD, but directly by the units with money that had been provided to them by what we would call fundraisers. I think we all know here wide number of examples. If you take the most famous Ukrainian ones, you've got, of course, Come Back Alive. If you take the international ones, you've got the one that is including our friend Constantine, Liberty for Ukraine Fund. But there's many, many other, big, some small, and altogether, they represent 3% of BMRD's budget. So what you might think here is, 3% is not that much. And at the end of the day, it's true. If you've got 2% in one place, well, you've got 97% in the other place. And of course, 97% is a lot more than 3%. Well done. You've mastered mathematics. But if you look at it more carefully, 3% of $100 million is $3 million. That means that on average, since the beginning of the war, $3 million are being sent by private individuals out of their own pockets from their bank account to the front line. This could be sent by international donors. This can be done by Ukrainian donors. And this also includes very probably the money that is spent by Ukraine's own soldiers to buy for their own equipment. And $3 million every day, that's a lot of money. The only example that I could come up with that could compare is Al-Qaeda. It's not a very sexy example. I'm very sorry. And I hope my Ukrainian friends will not be upset if I compare their fight for freedom with Al-Qaeda. But Al-Qaeda was the first international organization, terrorist but fighting organization, that was funded by international donations. Their entire budget, at the maximum entire budget for a year, according to the CIA, $60 million. And they had Saudi princes giving them money. They had people from the world over stealing money for them. They had a lot of effort. They put a lot of effort into $60 million. That's 20 days of international support for Ukraine. 20 days. This gives you an idea of how massive, actually, this number is. And if you look at the numbers from the point of view of a military person, which I'm not, you can see easily that the comparison 3-7 is not exactly correct. Because with a few exceptions, and I'd like to salute our Czech friends who bought entire Bayraktar drones, as well as the Lithuanians, with those exceptions, the money that is being spent tend to go to much smaller items. Those items, they can be anything between ear protections, to gloves, to smaller drones, to radios. All those little things that the Ukrainian MOD cannot really buy because they don't have the money. They need to concentrate on the big stuff. And the smaller things, they're being paid for through generosity, basically. And this is absolutely crucial because, again, not a military person, but I've discovered something wonderful, which is called a weapon system. Yeah, I know, so just laughing your head off at the moment, but for knobs like me, a weapon system is actually not exactly a weapon. It's more of a galaxy of gizmos that allow a weapon to function. So if you take, I don't know, a sniper rifle, that includes the rangefinder, the rifle itself, the scope, and it might also include, for instance, the radio that the spotter is using to communicate with the sniper. All this together creates a weapon system. And what our donations allow is to generate to round up those weapon systems. It's great to have HIMARS. If you don't have a radio to communicate the position of the enemy, HIMARS is useless. If you don't have a drone to spot the enemy when he arrives, the M777 is useless. So what we're doing by giving the money is to help round up the system. And because we're talking about system, sometimes very, very small items are absolutely crucial. I'm thinking some neoprene socks that are being put on some items that allow them not to freeze during the winter. That costs $2. Well, your $2, if you only have $2 to give, your $2 will buy this little item that will allow the whole system to function during the winter. And that gives you an idea of how important every dollar is in this process. But there's something else. From the point of view of force design, this is very, very interesting. And here I'd like to thank John Ridge for talking about this on Twitter with Rob Lee. It's the fact that to generate these flows of money, this fundraising, you need to be a well-established unit. You need to be a unit with a track record. You need to be a unit which has had time to develop relationships with international fundraisers. It's not something that happens like this. Put a helmet on the guy, give him a gun, go. You need to create those contacts. You need to create those ideas. You need to start raising this money. And what John Ridge and Rob Lee explained, and it's an assumption from their part, but I think it's pretty smart. It's the fact that if you look at the, let's call it a failure of some of the new brigades early in the war, part of it might be explained by the fact that they did not have contact with the fundraisers. They arrived, they were fresh, they only had the equipment from MOD, they did not have the drones, they did not have the rangefinders, they did not have the radios. And that's why, in part, probably, that at least that helps explain why they went headfirst into a trap. A trap that not only a more experienced, but a better equipped company, better equipped battalion would not, that's a mistake that a better equipped battalion would not have made. And I was talking about force design, and that is something that is pretty interesting. Because if you think about it, we've been laughing at the Chechens because they were TikTok warriors, and they were ridiculous. That being said, I'm starting to wonder, whereas each unit, at the very least in the Ukrainian army, and probably in many other armies in the world, each unit is not going to need its own TikTok warriors very, very soon. Those TikTok warriors will have two missions. The first one is to communicate. And we all know how difficult it is just to do it properly, to write good posts, to show good pictures, to be engaging, but also to do it while respecting the object. That's extraordinarily difficult. And that's the first mission. And their second mission is to use this communication as a springboard to access fundraisers to start getting the money they need to advance. I think that the alternative to this is to have a much more rigid, much more centralized system that would allow every unit from the get-go to get the goodies. The problem is that it's probably well nigh impossible to do. Yes, the Ukrainians are very, very good at communication, but I don't think they're good enough to replace the likes of Constantine, who comes to us and says, guys, my friend Ihor is here. he has lost his ambulance. He needs a new one. Give me $3,000 so I can buy a new one. This personal aspect, like a guy I know has a guy he knows who has a very precise need. This is irreplaceable. This is a massive, massive asset that the Ukrainian army as a whole has managed to develop. Unfortunately, not every unit is as well versed in this, but this is one of the reasons why in the future, hopefully, when new units will be developed, they won't only take new guys and put them on the front line, even with the best NATO training. Because there's one thing for sure that NATO is not giving you, it's TikTok training. What they need is this sort of, I'm sorry to say it like this, TikTok warriors that will give them access to the rest of the world's consciousness and to the rest of the world's pocket money. That's what they need, and I will never be so bold as to make any recommendation to the Ukrainian army, but I would strongly suggest that they at the very least consider the possibility of developing their very own TikTok warriors. And on this, I give back the mic.
Thank you very much, Ben. So up next, we have John is going to tell us a little bit about ATACMS and anything else over the last week or so that he feels might be worth discussing. So John, over to you.
Thank you very much, Joseph. So the major news item of the past 48, 72 hours has been the reporting from ABC citing two unnamed U.S. officials that has since been, corroborated or supported by publications in the Financial Times, citing yet another unnamed U.S. official and also including some comments from Andriy Yermak, Zelensky's chief of staff, as well as some comments from Kuleba, Ukraine's foreign minister, indicating that the White House is close to reaching a decision to provide Ukraine with ATACMS, which is the only and the primary tactical ballistic missile system used by the United States Army and a number of other foreign operators. As I'm sure we're all well aware by now, Ukraine has been requesting ATACMS for the past 18 months. It has particular value against very specific target sets that are not easily accessible to, say, Storm Shadow, Taurus, or any of the other munitions that they have thus far received, most notably time-sensitive targets. Being a ballistic missile, it's a very short time of flight, whereas enabling it to reach targets that would otherwise be able to move or displace before a Storm Shadow or Taurus could successfully prosecute them. And in addition, particularly with some of the older ATACMS with cluster munition warheads, they have particular utility against dispersed targets such as airfields, heliports, etc. What's particularly interesting about this reporting, and I see Colby has come up, is the DOD ref, based upon the comments of these two officials, it seems the DOD quote-unquote realized that they had more ATACMS in inventory than they initially thought. I'm not going to get into any particular specific figures of U.S. ATACMS inventory, specifically because Colby has a thread coming out in the next few days that has a near-exact breakdown of U.S. ATACMS inventory based upon a decade-plus of budgetary filings. That will be discussed in great detail there. Assuming the Pentagon isn't just trying to cover themselves in some way, my best guess is that they would be referring to the very, very significant number of expired ATACMS of both unitary and cluster munition variants that we have in inventory. The number is eye-wateringly large, particularly if the Ukrainians are willing to accept expired stock. That could open up some more flexibility on our end in terms of the inventory that we have available to provide to them. Colby, is there anything you'd like to add to this?
Yeah, I thought about this for a while, and I'll just offer a little preview since I'll be talking about this. And I'm skeptical of the reasoning provided by the unnamed officials in regard to them just scouring the extra inventory.
Obviously, we should treat this news with a decent bit of not just skepticism in regard to whatever explanation that the DOD is providing, but just overall caution in regard to the reporting. There have been at least there have been 1 to 2 false alarms, somewhat vaguely similar to this before, and we were all got burned, everybody that got excited about it, myself included. But so I would encourage some caution in the interim. If my memory is correct, the sourcing on this seems, I guess, a little bit more substantial than the previous false alarms. On the previous occasions, it was essentially one outlet citing one random anonymous source. Now we have 2 outlets citing 3 different anonymous sources. So I guess that is a quantitative improvement compared to last time, but I would still encourage caution for the moment. So in terms of what could be provided, depending on the level of additional operational risk that the White House and DOD are willing to take on, it would be feasible to potentially provide some number on the order of low hundreds of either unitary or cluster munition attackums, or some combination thereof, depending on what the Ukrainians assess their need to be. That shouldn't be a major issue. Kind of the big unknown here is that most likely the majority of U.S. attackums are likely stocked for contingencies involving North Korea. So a lot of this is going to come down to, again, what level of operational risk is United States forces Korea, as well as, you know, in consultation with the government of South Korea, what level of additional risk can we reasonably take on there? More broadly, how exactly do these expired attackums factor into our overall assessments for our requirements for munitions for these various contingencies?
We discovered that the inventory is a little bit larger than we originally thought it was. I'm skeptical of this because the Missiles in Space Program Office, who's responsible for the attackums program, they had originally planned to refurbish the entirety of the expired attackums inventory. So, and that was as of just like a few years ago. So in order for the Department of Defense to be unaware of all these missiles, that would mean that everybody at the Missiles in Space PEO would have had just forgotten about the fact that a few years ago they knew exactly how many expired missiles they had, and they had actually planned on refurbishing all. So I'm a little bit skeptical about the explanation here that, oh, we didn't know that these were sitting in a warehouse somewhere. Don't really buy that, and you'll see all the details behind that when I publish.
Carl, is there anything else you want to let people know about the attackums situation?
That's probably the most concise summary that I can give, or that either of us can give, given that we only have a couple minutes left. But the only other thing I might add is that in terms of specific target sets, obviously I mentioned airfields, heliports, etc. Probably the other major consideration, again, in terms of these mobile targets that are inaccessible to Storm Shadow or potentially Taurus at some point, are really the S-300P, S-300V, and S-400 batteries and other mobile SAM systems. That really is the optimal use case for them, as well as potentially some of the TELs for, say, Russian land attack missiles, be it the K-300P that launches Onyx, or potentially any Iskander-M TELs that are located in Crimea. Those are potential options as well, but I suspect the focus will primarily be on airfields, heliports, and then long-range SAM systems such as S-300 and S-400 that, again, have all been previously inaccessible for most practical purposes, even though they have received Storm Shadow.
Excellent. So we'll go just a little bit longer just because we got a few messages about it asking questions. So, John, we were just curious if you had anything to say about maybe the stuff that's been going on with Starlink this week, maybe even not about the specific incident and all the stuff around that, but just about the technology itself, or if you want to speak to any specific stuff going on, feel free. But, if there's anything you wanted to explain to the audience about that.
Yeah, so Starlink, there has been a truly breathtaking volume of really, really bad takes about that entire incident. Enormously frustrating. What I would say, without getting too much into the specifics of what is alleged to have occurred, the two big unknowns from my perspective are that we don't know the form and content of whatever SpaceX's contract was concerning the use of Starlink, and we also don't know whether or not SpaceX applied for and received a export license under ITAR for Starlink to be used on USVs and for other specific military applications in Ukraine. Without knowing either of those two things, or without knowing both of them, really, it's very difficult to pass judgment on what exactly happened there. But kind of looking beyond that, how the situation ended up being resolved is that, and this is what should have been done from the beginning, and it's really unfortunate that it wasn't done like this from the beginning, was rather than having the Ukrainian government directly contract with SpaceX to provide Starlink services, they're now being contracted via the DoD through what is known as the Starshield program. This is a product that SpaceX had previously pitched to the DoD even before the invasion. Essentially, the idea is that SpaceX would assemble a miniature Starlink constellation specifically for the DoD, and the DoD would get essentially complete control of that constellation. The satellites, the terminals that interface with the constellation, that would all be more or less contractually licensed, the management of that, to the DoD, so they can choose to use it however they wish, to enable whoever they want to use it however they wish, and to use it for whatever purpose they wish. That would be just taken off of SpaceX's hands entirely. They would just launch the satellites, provide the terminals, and, you know, provide technical support, and that's basically it. The DoD was very interested in that product and that service before the invasion. What looks like happened is that to resolve the issue, the DoD just basically procured that product perhaps earlier than they intended to. So SpaceX, rather the DoD, licensed the rights to operate a bunch of the Starlink satellites and purchased like 100,000 terminals, 100,000 plus terminals from SpaceX. Those satellites and those terminals, they are managed by the DoD, so any kind of geofencing or limitations on their use, that is determined by the DoD, not SpaceX. All of those have been provided to the MOD, to the Ukrainian MOD. So that seems to have largely resolved most of the issues. Previously, I believe SpaceX had donated some number of terminals and subscriptions themselves at the beginning. And then from there on out, it was mainly USAID and the Polish government that was purchasing them on Ukraine's behalf. That structure no longer looks like it exists, and the bulk orders will go through the DoD and then to the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. So the kind of incident that we saw involving the USVs and the, you know, specifics of Starlink being geofenced, that should hopefully not occur again, because that is now all being managed directly by the DoD. Really, the only potential issue that we have looking forward now is the fact that the Ukrainian MOD, their, let's just say, their distribution of the terminals is not necessarily complete or ideal, in the sense that there are Ukrainian units that need Starlink terminals either entirely or that need more than they currently have, and they aren't receiving them through the normal process via the Ukrainian MOD. So they are either from their own money going out and purchasing commercial terminals, or raising money with volunteers, or being donated terminals and subscriptions by volunteers. None of that is under the Starshield initiative. So, you know, potential geofencing issues, all of that still probably applies to those terminals, which I suspect is going to be the future pain point going forward. But the improvement here is that should now represent a minority of the overall terminals being used in Ukraine.
Thanks, Sean. Daniele, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for bringing this this topic. And just a question, maybe I misunderstood. So the US MOD is going to buy from SpaceX some terminal they're using in a separate way, or they are going to launch new Starlink and manage the satellite themselves?
So the Starshield, as originally proposed, I believe it would have included new satellites. Obviously, for the past 9 months, SpaceX has continued, as just part of their normal operations, continued to launch additional Starlink satellites and expand the size of the constellation. The reporting indicates that it looks like some existing satellites that were already on orbit were licensed to the DoD, as well as, in addition, the DoD procured more than 100,000 terminals and subscriptions for those terminals that they will be able to have complete control and management over. So it's possible that some of the newly launched satellites are part of Starshield. I don't know for certain, but the implications seem to be that at the time that the procurement was initially made at the beginning of this year, that SpaceX probably licensed some existing satellites on orbit to the DoD.
Yeah, but my This follow-up question comes from the fact that there has been long time concern about Starlink satellite deorbiting, and now I want to say finally, part of me say finally, there are proof that they have problem in keeping them in orbit due to the fact that they orbit very, very low. So they have a very low orbit and very particular ones, so they tend to deorbit quite easily. There is any take on that from the MOD? So they may be given a satellite that have left not that much, or they are completely new, so that there is any update on these regards? Because this was this exploded, but in reality, the community around this stuff was very well aware of the problem.
Right. So specifics of that have not been published, as far as I'm aware, in terms of which specific Starlink satellites the DoD got licensed. SpaceX in general, I mean, the rate at which they are placing new satellites in orbit exceeds the rate at which they're losing satellites to orbital decay. So I wouldn't anticipate that that's an issue. I believe off the top of my head, I think the satellites have a rated lifespan of, I think, 5 to 6 years off the top of my head.
Okay, thanks a lot, John. So before we wrap up today, we're going to have CJ give just a very brief military overview of some recent events, and then we're going to close out. Go ahead, CJ.
Can I talk about the thing I was meant to talk
about?
Yeah,
we were going to close out with this because I felt like that was like the appropriate time, but maybe this is a good time instead. Go ahead, Ben.
Okay. Yeah, we're all looking at Ukraine and what's unraveling, and it's normal. But at the same time, I wanted to say that all our hearts are going to our American friends who have been very good friends of Ukraine, sending their Caesar guns, sending T-72s, as well as a number of other stuff. They've been Ukraine's best friend in the Arab world, probably Ukraine's best friend in Africa, and they've been hit by an earthquake. Thousands are dead, and entire villages have been raised at the moment. People are trying to save their loved ones with bare hands. There's very little we can do, obviously, but if you can keep them in your thoughts and maybe drop them a few likes, a few supporting words, that would be great. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Ben. We'll go ahead and wrap up with the military update. Go ahead, CJ.
Yeah, I really just have two key points from American officials. As an American myself, that's why I'm bringing it up. Doesn't mean they're always the most accurate with what's going on in Ukraine necessarily, but I recommend everyone try and see the ABC or CBS interview with General Milley that just came out, and the cell that's basically an OSINT cell actually collecting information and sort of helping Ukraine from far away alongside other agencies, and is definitely making a difference. So the first note is about our artillery usage, of course, that is what I do around these parts. But, you know, since about the third week of May, you know, Ukraine has ramped up the amount of artillery it's been firing to reportedly 6,000 to 8,000 rounds a day, which when you look at Russia's numbers from last summer, which were somewhere around 60,000 rounds a day, seems like a drop in the bucket. But what you have to keep in mind is that's more than double what they've been shooting daily, and now amounts to somewhere, you know, about 110 days after the increase, to almost 1 million rounds of artillery fired, which is, you know, quite a lot still. So we have the EU working through a deal to get, you know, 1 million rounds starting in March. We have increased U.S. production, and this production increases all around the world to try and help. The U.S. officials said they didn't believe it was sustainable, but we also know a couple of other things. The U.S. officials said that they didn't think was sustainable, that Ukraine proved them wrong. So with that, we'll have to wait and see a bit. Next, of course, is the remarks from the DoD regarding F-16s, and also the Ukrainian remarks regarding it. Ukraine is very optimistic that they can get some of their pilots back, trained, ready, and all the structure in place by February. If that's met, it'll probably be very few planes, but more symbolic than anything, and the start of what will be, you know, I think John's got the most recent numbers of the pledged aircraft, but, you know, even if it's only a couple in February, by summer, it'll be a lot more. So that is pretty good news as well. And the last thing on ATACMS, of course, I think, I know there's some people that have brought to me, there is some sort of Russian software upgrade. It's been given to air defenses. That doesn't exist to the best of my knowledge. However, what we have to keep in mind is Russia has had a year to prepare. So they're not stupid. They're a sinking organization, especially their army, and they're going to be a little bit more ready now than they were previously. But I just wanted to hit sort of lastly on the psychological impact of ATACMS. I know Charles brought up the psychological impact of DPICM, the cluster munitions, when we talked about it, I believe in June or right before they got there. And she brought something up, having seen them and defused them in Iraq, that I had not considered, and I've been thinking about ever since, which was the idea that, you know, these sort of very dangerous and wounding weapons, more so than anything else, will cause, you know, psychological terror amongst the Russians. And I think we've seen that play out pretty well. There's a lot more Russians injured, and what that's led to is drain on their medical systems as Ukraine, you know, uses more and more DPICM as they perhaps run lower on other types of ammunition. With the TACMS, people were a little bit concerned that perhaps this information shouldn't be out there, right? That there was a drawback and Ukraine should suddenly get them one day. And I would disagree, and I'll leave everyone with this, you know, sort of the impact of the TACMS. There's a psychological impact there. It's not some sort of wonder weapon that's going to change everything, but it means even if now they're not given for a while, Russia has to respond to the reports. They simply have to. They have to move command posts even more. They have to move how they distribute ammo. They have to move people around. They have to change almost by every single warfighting function what they do without a single ATACMS being fired at them. That's very complicated to do. And if they've been training well and rehearsing well, it still will be a massive muscle movement to get everything switched up in the middle of them, you know, also trying to counterattack and defend and do a relatively complex defense, which we could argue about how effective the counteroffensive is, but this will not make it any easier. And it doesn't even require the U.S. or anyone else to give them ATACMS. It's just this word alone. So people just keep that in mind, too, that that's, you know, the cost of moving a command post from 100 kilometers away to now more than 300 kilometers away, that has an impact. And we'll have to see how well Russians have planned for this day. And maybe they've planned well, but it still will certainly not hurt Ukraine for them to have them. So, yeah, thank you, Joseph, for giving me a little bit of time here at the end.
Of course. Thank you, CJ. And so we'll go ahead and close out to our live listeners. If you are interested in more open source information about the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine, Toshny does recommend Michael Bond's base, which I believe this week will be going live. It should be live already. So head on over there if you guys want more information. Thank you, of course, to our audience for listening to Toshny Weekly. We do broadcasts live every week. A recording of this episode and all our content is made available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. So feel free to go there for all of our content and please subscribe and like the podcast or rate it. Thank you to our excellent panel this week for all their contributions. And thanks again. We hope you enjoy the broadcast. Please tune in next week and Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава.
On behalf of the brave.